Most bodybuilders make a basic mistake, which from one perspective it might be said, that this mistake accounts for all of their other mistakes, and it is that they don't take this goal endeavor seriously enough, at least to remember one crucial point, that bodybuilding really is a part of exercise science. I am not suggesting that one must be a full-fledged exercise scientist or a PhD in exercise physiology to be a successful bodybuilder, of course not. It would argue one of education, however, to deny that a firm grasp of the fundamental principles of bodybuilding science would be to the individual's decided advantage. The first thing one learns when studying exercise science formally in college is something that many already know, or are at least familiar with, and it is that the field of exercise science is divided into two fundamentally distinct branches, namely aerobic and anaerobic. While there may be those listening that probably already know some of this early preliminary material, let it be known that I am not merely going through a perfunctory review here to eat up time. These basic points are being raised so that I'm certain you have them clear and clean in your mind. Then I will connect them to new ideas in the attempt to create a logically clear perspective. Aerobic exercise, of course, is geared exclusively to the development of endurance of a certain type, and is properly defined as low-intensity, long-duration activity. This last statement, listener, is very important. You might make a note. I'll repeat it. Aerobic exercise is properly defined as low-intensity, long-duration activity. Bodybuilding is a part of the opposite branch, anaerobic, and that is vitally important also, so please write it down. The fact that aerobic and anaerobic are to be regarded as opposites, and I'll elaborate on why that's important shortly. Anaerobic exercise is not geared ordinarily to the development of endurance, although there is something called anaerobic endurance, which is not relevant here. Instead, anaerobic exercise is geared to the development of strength, muscular size and speed, and is properly defined as high-intensity, short-duration activity. High-intensity, short-duration activity. It is this. Precisely this, high-intensity, short-duration activity that is responsible for the development of muscles beyond normal size, not long, drawn-out bouts of endurance-type activity. One of the major reasons so many people are having difficulty grasping what I have been communicating on this subject is that they have failed to take the time, give some serious thought, and adequately distinguish between the two species of exercise, aerobic and anaerobic. Remember, they are literally opposites and have to be regarded thusly. Where it may be appropriate to train aerobically 3 times a week for up to an hour or more, as the goal is to increase one's endurance, which means the capacity to do more and more work, such is not proper with the opposite, anaerobic, precisely because it is the opposite. They are opposites with opposite approaches for each required. My greatest success as a trainer involves a young phone consultation client from Canada by the name Gareth. An interesting name, Gareth. During one of his follow-up phone calls, I nicknamed him Growth, as he recently, in a 9-week period, gained literally 50 pounds, mostly of muscle. This fine young man has been a regular phone client for 2 straight years, and while Gareth, or Growth, has always made good progress, never until recently of the order just described. Whereas, in the past, he would train once every 72 to 144 hours, or once every 3 to 5 days for 30 to 40 minutes, Gareth made his greatest progress by far, training for approximately 20 minutes once every 7 days. Gareth is so excited by his progress, as well as by his better and more relaxed understanding of the issue of training frequency, that he agreed to do an experiment where he trains only once every 10 days. If you are incredulous, listener, that such progress is possible, then you have already forgotten. Aerobic and anaerobic are opposites. We are beginning to see that where, again, it may be appropriate to train aerobically, where the physiologic stresses are quite low, for 3 or 4 times a week, for an hour or more, that with high-intensity, anaerobic, weight-resistance exercise, where the stresses are literally almost infinitely greater, only 3 to 6 workouts a month for 15 to 20 minutes each proves most productive. when I stated that the stresses involved with high-intensity anaerobic exercise are infinitely greater than the stresses associated with aerobic exercise, I meant it literally. While an individual in good physical condition can tolerate aerobic exercise for up to an hour with little distress, project how you might feel, listener, were you to attempt 1 hour of non-stop maximum heavy squatting. Yes, you may even be chuckling. The mind balks at the mere suggestion. No one could tolerate that. The high-intensity stress would kill him well before an hour had elapsed. Occasionally, when I sign up a new training client locally in Venice, California, where I conduct my personal training business, the client, by the end of the first workout, will look at his watch and remark, "Well, Mr. Mensah, that was only 20 minutes. I feel like I can do a lot more." And my stock reply to such has become, "Well, sir, if I'm to take your statement at face value, I would have it that you'd like to have me train you until you can't do any more, and you have to leave the gym in an ambulance." The point here is that many bodybuilders have lodged in their subconscious the mistaken notion that bodybuilding exercise involves an endurance component, which it does not. Bodybuilding, as I stated earlier, has little or nothing to do with endurance. Many bodybuilders today still seem to be operating on the notion that their purpose is to go into the gym to see how many sets they can do or discover how long they can endure. And this is erroneous because bodybuilding is not aerobic. A bodybuilding workout, in other words, is not an endurance contest. Your purpose is not to go into the gym to see how tough you are, how much work you can perform, or how long you can endure. Your actual, literal purpose as a bodybuilder is to go into the gym and intelligently do what nature requires to trigger the growth mechanism into motion, then get the hell out, go home, rest, and grow. So what if your workouts only take 20 minutes? So what? Bodybuilding training literally has nothing to do with endurance. I make a point in my new book, Heavy Duty 2, Mind and Body, which I am quite proud of, as I don't believe anyone has ever established this point before, at least not so thoroughly or firmly, and it is that the principle of intensity is not merely important, it is much more than that. It is the cardinal fundamental of exercise science, the intellectual foundation of the whole field. That's correct, not merely important, but the intellectual foundation of all of exercise science. How do I justify such a bold statement? Well, let's look back to the definitions of the two basic branches which make up the whole of exercise science, aerobic and anaerobic. They are both defined primarily in terms of intensity. Aerobic is low intensity, anaerobic high intensity. And that's the point. If the two basic branches which make up the field of exercise science are defined primarily in terms of intensity, then intensity is the cardinal element. You may have noticed that more and more writers in the bodybuilding field have been using the term intensity as of late, but very few use it properly. Let it be made clear that the term high intensity is not one that I concocted to sound pretentious or falsely technical. It is the proper scientific terminology. In fact, the terms high intensity and anaerobic can be used interchangeably. Exercise scientists who deny the validity of high-intensity training theory either forgot or never were aware in the first place that high-intensity and anaerobic are essentially the same thing. Intensity, you see, is a measure of effort. And what is exercise essentially about? Efforts of various types. Without a method for measuring the level of effort, one doesn't know what is most centrally important about the nature of the training stress or stimulus, and therefore he won't know how to regulate the volume or frequency of the effort to ensure optimal results from the exercise. This is fundamentally what exercise bodybuilding science is about. When it is understood that the level of effort or intensity is low, then we also know that the demands on the body's limited reserve of biochemical resources, known as recovery ability, are also low. And obviously more of that exercise can be tolerated in the way of both volume and frequency. When one is clearly aware, on the other hand, that the level of effort is very high, then we know that the demands are high and the volume and frequency must be low. Something I learned a number of years ago while studying philosophy and logic, which has helped to improve the quality of my thinking enormously, relates to the crucial role of unequivocal or precise definitions. Concepts, of course, are the tools of thought. If the major concepts involved in one's thinking aren't held in clearly defined form, then his thinking will not be clear or logical either. What I would like to do now, listener, is give you the precise meaning of the concept intensity as an important step towards teaching you to think logically about the subject of exercise. Not the concept high intensity or low intensity, but the concept intensity. Please write this down. Intensity refers to the percentage of possible momentary muscular effort being exerted. I'll say it again. Intensity refers to the percentage of possible momentary muscular effort being exerted. In philosophy, such a definition would be regarded as highly abstract or technical, which may be difficult to grasp. I'll repeat it one last time. Intensity refers to the percentage of possible momentary muscular effort being exerted. I clearly recall the first time I read that definition about 25 years ago. I hadn't the slightest clue as to what it meant. I had to read it over and over and over before I gained even a glimmering of meaning. I do understand the meaning of the concept very well now. I also understand that the best way to clarify a highly abstract definition is to go to a concrete example in perceptual reality. Let's assume that you, for instance, the listener, hypothetically at least, for the sake of this illustration, were capable of curling a 100-pound barbell for a maximum of 10 reps to failure. And by that I mean you couldn't possibly perform an 11th rep. In fact, the 10th rep requires a maximum all-out effort where you're gritting your teeth, shaking all over, and you barely complete that rep. Now, bear in mind, please, what we're doing here. We're going to examine a real-life, concrete example, a set of barbell curls with 100 pounds for 10 reps to failure, so as to gain a better understanding of the meaning of intensity. But before I do, I'd like to make a few oblique comments. You may have been aware that over the past few years, and more so recently, a considerable amount of critical commentary has been aimed at the theory of high intensity, even me personally. In effect, a number of people have been saying, how could anybody be so damn dumb? How could Mentzer believe that only one set could possibly be enough? He seems like a bright fellow otherwise, but he has a critical blind spot here. One set couldn't possibly be enough. And the reason that they are having a difficult time grasping that such might be possible is that they have allowed themselves to become mindlessly hypnotized by the mere number itself, the number one. They just hate the number one here. And I must say, I'd rather have $100 than $1 too. But then, we're not talking about economics or personal finances either. The context is exercise science. What these individuals have failed to do, listener, is what you and I are about to do, and that is to forget the number one and instead look at the nature. The key term is nature. Look at the nature of what that one thing is. You see the distinction. Forget the number one and look at the nature of what that one thing is. Were you to point out to these same individuals that there are those who may require only one, again the unit or number one, 1 hour of exposure to high intensity sunlight stress to develop a suntan, they might be surprised it's still the number one. If you don't like the number one, you could alter the standard of notation. Instead of 1 hour of high intensity sunlight, you might say 100 zillion photon units of light, a very large number. Or instead of one set, you could say 100 units of intensity. You may know of the top bodybuilder, Flex Wheeler. Flex trains at Gold's Gym in Venice, California, again where I conduct my personal training business. Flex trains with a partner, a big fellow named Rico McClinton. Rico knows that I've trained Dorian Yates in the past, and he has apparently read some of my work. Over the past 2 years or so, Rico has made it a habit to periodically tease me at the gym on this subject, but always in a good-natured fashion. Every now and then, Rico would pipe up so all of his gym buddies could hear and get a laugh. "Hey, Mentzer," he would say, "you still believe that crap only one set is all you need to grow?" And at different times, I would use varying analogies to jog his thinking, to provide Rico with a different perspective on the issue. Things like, "Well, Rico, it only takes one bullet to kill a person, So why can't one set be adequate to stimulate growth? Or on another occasion, it only takes one well-placed blow from a hammer to stimulate the explosion of a stick of dynamite, with no number of lesser blows having the same effect. And he was never impressed by such. Then here recently he said it again. Mike, you really believe that stuff, don't you? It only takes one set to stimulate growth. Now I did note this time at least Rico was using the proper terminology, stimulate growth. In fact, he seemed more sincere about the issue. This time, however, I stopped Rico cold, providing him with what just may be the perfect analogy. Rico, I said, only one sperm was required from your daddy to stimulate the growth of your mother's egg into a fully fashioned human baby, namely you. Only one sperm, literally, to stimulate the growth of all of your skeletal muscles and your skeleton, in fact, also your skin, guts, hair, brains, and so forth. Rico was highly impressed and said, Mike, you got me with that one. Nothing more to say. I'll never bother you about it again. What I did was give Rico a new perspective on the issue of number one. And what I'm asking you, the listener, to do is to discard what you thought you knew and take a fresh, new, unobstructed look at this subject. Now, back to that set of curls with 100 pounds for 10 reps to failure, so you might gain a better understanding of intensity. Let's look at the nature of it. Let's start in the beginning with the first rep. Of all the reps of the set, the first rep obviously would be the easiest, requiring the least intensity of effort. Or, referring to the definition of intensity that you've written down, one would say that the first rep requires the least percentage of his possible momentary muscular effort of all the reps of the set. Allow me to explain this point a little further, then we'll move more briskly straight ahead, I promise. If you were to look outside right now and happen to see a loved one pinned under the front wheel of a car, we've all heard stories like this, you would dart out there as quickly as you possibly could, and in the attempt to remove the automobile, you would exert yourself with 100% of your possible momentary muscular effort. Or to make it more simple from here on, let's just plug in the word for the definition. You would exert yourself with 100% intensity of effort. Now, the first rep of that set of curls would not require anywhere near 100% intensity of effort. Again, it would be the easiest rep of the set. That first rep does fatigue you somewhat, however, and that is why the second rep is at least a little bit harder to complete. Whereas, the first rep may require on the order of 8 to 10% intensity of effort, the second rep, you see, may require closer to 15 to 20% intensity of effort. The second rep fatigues you even further still, and that's why the third is even harder to complete than was the second. And without belaboring the issue, you know that's how it goes with each successive rep of the set. Each becomes progressively harder to complete. Each requires more intensity of effort than did the preceding, until finally, we get to the last rep in this case, the 10th rep to failure. That would be the only rep which is said to require 100% intensity of effort, just like trying to lift the automobile. Now the important question. Which rep, listener, would be more productive in terms of stimulating a strength and size increase? The first rep, which is the least intense, or the last rep, which is the most intense? The only rep requiring 100% intensity of effort. Yes, of course, the last. If you could curl 100 pounds for a maximum of 10 reps, and for some weird reason you only ever just did the first, and then put the bar right back down at that point, you would never grow. Why? Because the intensity of the stress at that point is not sufficiently threatening to the physiology to warrant an adaptive response, i.e., a strength and muscle mass increase. Just like you can't obtain a suntan sitting in front of a 100-watt light bulb, even if you sit there for an infinity of eternities. The stress is not high enough. Do you see where it stands to reason that if the last rep is more productive than the first rep, it is also better than the second, third, fourth, fifth, and so on? Yes, in fact, that last rep is quite special. It is different from every other rep of the set. There is something that occurs physiologically only on that last rep of a set carried to failure, which is literally responsible for flipping on the growth machinery inside the muscle. How is that last rep different? What occurs physiologically at that point, which makes the last rep so special? Well, no one understands all of the biochemical or physiologic changes entirely. Some of the changes or differences are readily apparent, however. For instance, compare your breathing on the first rep of the set compared to the last. On the first rep, your breathing is not labored at all. Your heart is beating normally, and you experience no distress. By the last rep, you are breathing like a racehorse. Your heart is pounding like a trip hammer, and you feel quite different. You feel stressed, perhaps even lightheaded or nauseous. Obviously, there is something different that is going on physiologically on that last rep, which makes it rather different. And now the important conclusion. Having achieved your purpose of triggering the growth mechanism into motion by going to failure on that one set, you don't have to do it again. You don't need a second set. It's like when you throw the switch to turn on a light. Once the light is on, you are confident that the electrical mechanism will remain in motion. There is no need to flip the switch up and down repeatedly. You just wear it out. There is much about the human being which is mechanistic. I am not speaking metaphorically when I refer to the growth mechanism. There is a physiologic growth mechanism, and your purpose, once again, is to do what nature requires to trigger that into motion by carrying one set to a point of momentary muscular failure. And having achieved that by going to failure on one set, it is neither necessary nor desirable to do another set. A note here with regard to the detractors of high-intensity training theory. When someone denies the validity of the theory, they are, in effect, denying the validity of the principle of intensity, which, recall, is the intellectual foundation of exercise science. In denying the principle of intensity, they are saying that the level of effort is not important, plays no role in stimulating growth, which is tantamount to saying that the first rep of a set of curls, for instance, carried to failure at 10 reps is just as likely to stimulate growth as the last. Anyone with a modicum of training experience, or a little common sense, knows that such is ludicrous, as of course the last rep, the most intense, the one requiring 100% intensity of effort, is the most productive rep. Quite often I'm asked if performing a second set would really make that much difference, and the answer is, not only would it make a difference, but going from one set to two is the biggest mistake of all, for it is the biggest increase possible, a 100% increase. Going from one set to two sets represents a 100% increase in the volume of the exercise, making for twice the inroad into recovery ability, and that's how it should be properly viewed. Often, when taking a new client through a workout, he'll note the fact that I have him performing but one set per exercise, whereupon he'll ask, "But Mike, you only have me doing one set. I feel like I should do another set." And I respond to the effect that the feeling he has is fear, specifically a fear that he hasn't performed enough exercise to stimulate growth. And that if he could provide me with one good reason, not two, just one good reason why I should consider allowing him to do one more set, I would consider it. And after all these years as a trainer, not one single individual has ever given me one good reason. And that is the issue, listener, precisely how many sets one should perform. If you honestly believe that one set is not enough, it is incumbent upon you to tell me precisely how many sets are required. Which brings me to the second fundamental of bodybuilding science, the issue pertaining to volume. Many years ago, Arthur Jones made a statement that struck me as remarkably intelligent and very important. He said, and I quote, "Mike, the issue of volume, or number of sets, is a negative factor or influence, period, insofar that one trains at all, whether he does one set or 100 sets, volume is a negative thing here. And that is because any exercise makes an inroad into the body's limited reserve of biochemical resources known as recovery ability." Close quote. To help you understand the concept inroad, you might visualize an in into the road, or a hole being dug into your body's limited reserve of resources. You perform one set and you dig a small hole, a second set a deeper hole, a third set an even deeper hole, and so on. This is a negative thing here, for the deeper the hole gets, the greater the inroad into the body's limited reserve of resources, the more of your body's resources then have to be used in the attempt to fill the hole, which is recovery, leaving that much less left over or available for building the mountain on top, the muscle. Ideally, one would stimulate growth with zero sets, then none of the body's resources would be wasted on recovery, with all of it being used for growth production, and one would grow so damn fast it would stagger the imagination. However, at this point in time, I haven't figured out how to stimulate growth with zero sets. Just joking, of course. Overtraining, by definition, means carrying on any more exercise than the precise amount required to stimulate growth. Most, however, seem to regard overtraining as something only kind of negative. Overtraining is much worse than that. It is precisely that which militates against muscle growth production. Don't make the mistake of thinking that overtraining is merely wasted effort. No, it is counterproductive. Again, it is exactly that which prevents you from growing. When you are finished working out, you don't feel the same as you did before the workout, do you? No, you're exhausted. And by exhausted, I don't mean merely in the personal sense that you feel very tired or fatigued, but also in the technical sense that you've exhausted or used up a considerable portion of your body's limited reserve of resources merely to fuel the workout.
This is the end of side one. Please turn over the tape at this point to continue with side two.
You actually feel like you're in a hole. You're tired. The first thing the body must do following a workout is not grow, but recover. Overcome the inroad. That is, fill that hole. Or as I like to say more precisely, compensate for the exhaustive effects of the workout. Or more simply, replenish, restore, put back what was used up, put back what was there before the workout. The body must first replace what was there before the workout, or compensate, before it can put back more than was there before the workout, or overcompensate, which of course is what growth is. Recovery is putting back what was there before, i.e. compensating, and growth is putting back more than was there before, i.e. overcompensating. Recovery, therefore, precedes growth. And if you train again before the body has completed both the recovery and the growth processes, growth production will be compromised, short-circuited, shy of 100 possible units. Important here is the fact that the process of recovery alone may take up to several days or longer to be completed before the body even has the opportunity to start producing the growth that the workout merely stimulated. Please note the distinction between growth stimulation and growth production. And if the trainee works out again before the recovery process is completed, he will short-circuit the growth production process and merely start digging another hole. When I first started training people some years ago, I had my clients train 3 days a week, every 48 hours, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, with weekends off. And while most of them did well, I was absolutely convinced that they weren't achieving the results I knew were possible. And I didn't attribute this to undertraining, but to overtraining. So as remedy, I reduced their training frequency to one workout every 72 hours. Now they were training on Monday, taking Tuesday and Wednesday off, then training Thursday, taking Friday and Saturday off, and training Sunday and so forth. While their progress was better, it still wasn't as good as I knew to be possible. Some might be prompted to ask the question at this point, well, Mentzer, what motivated you to continue thinking in this direction? It was something I learned from philosophy, that when in possession of a truly valid theory, and beyond that, and just as important, you're making the proper practical application of the theoretical principles, progress will be little short of spectacular all the time, no matter what the field of endeavor, whether you're sending a man to the moon, performing surgery, or developing muscle mass beyond normal levels. I had to admit that my clients' progress wasn't always thus. It wasn't until I reduced their training frequency to once every 4 to 7 days, back in February of 1995, that voila, they finally started achieving results of the order I always knew were possible. Where prior to that, I would only occasionally have a client gain 10 to 20 pounds in a month, or 30 to 40 pounds in 3 to 5 months, Since February of 1995, such results have been the rule. I was initially reluctant to go to once every 4 to 7 days, as I, like everyone else apparently, had blindly and uncritically accepted the notion that decompensation starts after 96 hours of no training. This was during a period of rigorous philosophic retraining on my part, when I had reached the conviction I would never, ever again blindly accept anything that mystical they had to say. They say, who is this they we all keep hearing about? I recall that many times I and numerous other bodybuilders of experience would remark, have you ever noticed that when you take a week or two layoff that you always come back stronger? And every single one, without exception, replied, you know, now that you mention it, yes, I have noticed that after a week or two off, I always come back stronger. I finally realized that if one comes back stronger after a week or two layoff, then he didn't decompensate. That is, grow weaker and smaller. No, he in fact overcompensated, just the opposite. He got stronger and didn't lose anything. Well, if you don't atrophy or decompensate after up to 2 weeks of no training, how in the hell is it going to happen after 4 days? It won't. And remember, it may take up to several days or longer just to compensate or recover from the workout. There is no decompensation after 4 to 7 days. No way, it just doesn't happen. I want to wrap up this section on theory with a broad general statement, on which I'll then elaborate briefly before describing the actual workout program. It is this, and I'd like you to write it down, please. Very important. The big picture in bodybuilding is comprised essentially of two elements of equal value, 50-50. Not 60-40 or 70-30, but 50-50. The first element, 50% of the big picture, of course, is the workout itself. And the other element, just as important as the workout, the other 50% is the rest period between workouts. And this is why that is true. The workout, you understand, does not actually produce muscle growth. Remember, the workout merely serves to stimulate or trigger the body's growth mechanism into motion. It is the body itself, of course, which actually produces the growth, but only if left undisturbed during a sufficient rest period. You don't rest enough, you don't grow enough. Now, if you accept my premise that the rest period between workouts is that important, do you see where it follows logically that there has to be a perfect or optimum number of days of rest, and anything less than that will compromise progress? And I have found that for most, one workout every 4 to 7 days, as I said before, is literally almost miraculous compared to any other frequency protocol. Okay, that's enough with training theory. I'd like to start this section on the actual training routine with a prefatory point. Only if there was a God would he have the luxury of being able to read your genetic material, your DNA, and say to you with absolute certainty, sir, thou shalt perform 4 sets per workout, once every 101 hours, any more, any less will compromise your progress. The point here, of course, is that I don't even have the luxury of being able to work with you in person, let alone read your DNA. Therefore, I can't guarantee anyone I'd start him out on the same baseline program the Almighty would. But then I ain't so sure it'd be all that different either, as at least we'd both be clear about the fundamental principles. I am going to suggest that everyone start with what I have determined, through vast personal experience as a trainer, works quite well for most. And if after finishing 3 cycles of the 4-workout program, your strength hasn't increased significantly, that you switch to the consolidation program, as described in the booklet that came along with these tapes. You might want to take notes on my description of the baseline program, although it too is contained in the booklet. I want to go over this one verbally, however, as there are numerous important points and details which I believe you'll better understand if I explain them on tape. Some of the points relate to safety, and as a personal trainer, of course, safety is always of paramount concern. You will start by training once every 4 days on a 4-workout protocol. So, if you start on a Monday, that means you wouldn't train again till Friday. After Friday, you wouldn't train again till Tuesday, then Saturday, and so forth, once every 4 days. And if a scheduling problem arises, so that you can't make it into the gym on day 4, take off one more day and train on day 5. Also, once you've been with the program for 3 weeks or so, start inserting an additional rest day or two, even at random. If you do, you should never hit a sticking point, and here's why. As you grow stronger week to week, as you will with this program, that is, as you lift progressively heavier weights, the stresses on the body grow progressively greater too. Until finally, unless you do certain things like add extra rest days,